Okay, so now we're going to try to solve this problem that we screwed up last time. We're going to try to solve it the right way. So remember, what we're trying to do is we're trying to solve the heat equation, ut equals uxx, and we're... Okay. And we're trying to solve this subject to an initial condition. Initial condition, u of x and 0 is, say, f of x. And we're trying to solve it with boundary conditions. So this is on the domain t greater than 0 and x between 0 and pi. Okay? And we're trying to solve this with initial conditions and boundary conditions. Boundary conditions are that u of 0 and t is, say, g of t, and u of pi and t is h of t. Okay? So you have to imagine that there's some domain that looks like this. Here's x. Here's t. And we're working in this domain here. So along this edge of the domain, we have u being equal to f of x. Here, u is equal to g of t, and here, it's equal to h of t. So these are boundary conditions. So we have a wire whose length is pi, okay? And this is pi. And on this wire, we have a heat bath keeping the temperature at g of t, a time-dependent heat bath, pretty fancy stuff. Here we have a time-dependent heat bath at the other edge of the wire. And the question is, how are we going to solve this problem? Now, this is the logic. Logic is that the solution to the heat equation is smooth. Okay? It's infinitely differentiable, in fact. We don't need it to be infinitely differentiable. We're happy if the solution is just continuous, but actually it's infinitely differentiable. Okay? So that means that even though the solution u does not vanish at x equals 0 and does not vanish at x equals pi, who cares? Okay? We can represent u of x and t in the form of a Fourier series. This is certainly true. Okay? So this will be a Fourier series of the sum and of the form n equals 1 to infinity sine of nx times a sub n of t. And the Fourier coefficients vary with t. Okay? So there's no question about the truth of this statement. That certainly is true. Of course, since u does not vanish at x equals 0 in general and at x equals pi in general, okay, we know that the coefficients a sub n of t for large n go like 1 over n as n goes to infinity. And we know that because we've already done that argument. We know that by just simple integration by parts. Okay, so this is what we expect. So as a result, while this is how we're going to represent the solution to the heat equation, this representation is not differentiable. Okay? Because if you should be so nasty as to try to differentiate this with respect to x, you will pull out a factor of n, and the series will diverge wildly. Okay, so that's terrible. We don't want to contemplate differentiating this, but at least we've represented the solution. Okay? Now, the other thing we want to know is, what is the solution going to behave like? You know, we have this initial condition that u of x and 0 is f of x. Okay? So we know what these Fourier coefficients are at t equals 0. So at t equals 0, we know that a sub n of 0 is equal to the integral from 0 to pi, 2 over pi, f of x times sine of nx dx. That we also know. Okay? And that's because All we have to do is set t equal to 0. We get the initial condition. We know all that. So what did we do wrong last time? You know what we did wrong. We just stupidly differentiated this representation and plugged it into the differential equation. We can't do that. Okay. So the question is, how are we going to proceed? And the answer is, it's easy. Okay. Because I have a formula for a sub, since I, of course, I have a formula for a sub n of 0. But in general, I have a formula for a sub n of t. Okay. So we know that a sub n of t is certainly equal to 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to pi dx sine of nx times u of x and t, just by definition. Okay, that is clearly the Fourier coefficient, the nth Fourier coefficient of the function u. Okay? So this is the statement, this is explicitly the formula for the a sub n's that we're using in this Fourier series representation. So just for laughs, let's differentiate this with respect to t. Now, we cannot differentiate the Fourier series. That we can't do. But we certainly can differentiate this. And if we do, we see that a sub n prime of t is 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to pi dx sine of nx times ut of x and t. Okay? We can differentiate under the integral sign, because while the Fourier series is not uniformly convergent, and we can't differentiate that term by term, this integral is, of course, uniformly convergent. There's no problem with the integral. Okay? So now we have u sub t. So how do we impose the heat equation? It's easy. Clearly, ut is equal to uxx. Okay? So now, think about what we've made use of so far. We certainly have used the initial condition that we have incorporated over here. Okay? And now we have incorporated the heat equation, which we weren't able to incorporate before. We've done it implicitly. Okay? But now we have this horrible integral. So that's no big deal. What am I going to do? Say it again, louder. I heard the whisper. Of course. So we're going to integrate by parts. So that's a natural thing to do. Okay. So it's clear we're going to integrate uxx, obviously. And we're going to be differentiating sine. So if we do one integration by parts, what do we get? We have 2 over pi. If you integrate uxx, you get ux of x and t times sine of nx evaluated from 0 to pi. Okay? And then we have minus 2 over pi integral from 0 to pi dx. Now we have ux of x and t times cosine of nx, the derivative of sine is cosine, times a factor of n. Okay. Now you're going to see something that maybe you haven't realized before. Okay? The point here is, suppose, instead of giving boundary conditions in the form of a heat bath, suppose I had tried to specify the heat flux. Suppose I had said, no, not, I don't want to use these boundary conditions. Suppose I had said, that ux of 0 and t is some function, j of t or something like that. Okay, suppose I had specified the heat flux at the boundary instead of the temperature at the boundary. Suppose I had done that. Okay? Okay? We would have a disaster. Can you see why? Why would we have a disaster? Do you see that I cannot incorporate that flux, the heat flux, over here? Why? Because at this endpoint, pi, and at that endpoint, what do I get? 0. So I couldn't incorporate the heat flux using this kind of Fourier series. Okay? In the current, okay, so what kind of Fourier series would I have used? Instead of a sine Fourier series, I would have used a cosine Fourier series. Okay? So it's very nice that we're using a sine series, because that's the natural series to use if I want to incorporate a heat bath. You notice at pi, this gives me u of x at pi and t times 0. So although I don't know the flux, this vanishes. So what I don't know drops out of the equation, okay, which is very nice. Okay, so this is 0 at the two endpoints, which is wonderful. So I don't know what the, so of course, once I know the answer, I can calculate the heat flux if I want. But here, I don't know the heat flux. It isn't given to me. But it drops out of the equation. It's very clever the way it works. It's really wonderful. Okay? So now I have left just this integral over here. And you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to integrate by parts again. Okay? So if I integrate by parts, this gives me minus 2n over pi times u of x and t cosine of nx evaluated from 0 to pi. I'm integrating ux. And then I subtract the derivative of the cosine. So I have three minus signs altogether, right? Three minus signs, which gives me one minus sign left. The derivative of cosine is n times sine. So I have 2n squared over pi, integral from 0 to pi, dx, u of x and t sine of nx. Okay? Okay? But now, let's evaluate this line. This gives me 2n over pi. Now, u at pi and t is known. It is the function h of t. And cosine of n pi is just minus 1 to the n. Okay? And at the lower end point, u of 0 and t is given as g of t. And cosine of 0 is 1. So now we have that. And over here, we have minus 2n n squared times 2 over pi times u times sine of nx. What is that? It's precisely a, isn't it? Uh-huh. So this is a sub n of t. So how do you like that? So this is just a simple differential equation for the Fourier coefficients. Okay? I could not differentiate the Fourier series, but I have now found a simple differential equation for the Fourier coefficients, and I have incorporated this boundary condition and this boundary condition. So it's all in there. All the information is in there. Okay? So I have to solve this differential equation subject to this initial condition. First order differential equation. I have the initial condition. Bang, the problem is solved. Now, isn't that magnificent? Isn't that beautiful, the way it works? Now, let's I don't want to make a lot of chicken scratchings on the blackboard. So let's simplify this a little bit. Let's assume, just for simplicity, let's just take h equals 0. Suppose that heat bath is just 0 for simplicity. So that'll throw away this term. But let's leave g, because I want you to see how it's working. Okay. So now, the differential equation that we have to solve is what? The differential equation is a sub n prime of t. I'm going to add this to the other side of the equation, plus n squared a sub n of t is equal to minus. So it's 2n over pi g of t. There you go. That's the differential equation we have to solve. OK? Does that look OK? Now, this is a first order equation. It's linear. How do you solve equations of that type? How do you solve it? Mm-hmm. Okay, what is the integrating factor? Yeah?
You multiply a function to both sides to have the derivative of.
Right.
You call that function mu with the derivative of an, derivative of an times mu.
Right, and mu is the integrating factor. Yeah. What is mu?
Exponential of GT dt. No.
This is just the right hand side. We don't care about G. It's this that we, that n squared t. That's all. Right. So the integrating factor is e to the n squared t, because if you multiply both sides by it, the left-hand side becomes the total derivative. Okay? It's that simple. So therefore, if we just multiply both sides, e to the n squared t, left-hand side becomes d by dt of a sub n of t, e to the n squared t. And the right-hand side becomes 2n over pi g of t, e to the n squared t. OK? And now to solve the equation, we just integrate it. OK? So the solution is a sub n of t, e to the n squared t, is the integral of this. OK? So it's the integral from 0 to t. I choose to integrate from 0 up to t, 2n over pi ds, that's a dummy integration variable, g of s, e to the n squared s. But we're integrating from 0, so there's an integration constant. So if we integrate both sides from 0 to t, on the left-hand side, we will have a sub n of 0, right? Which I'm going to put over on the right-hand side, plus a sub n of 0, which we know. That's the initial condition. Okay? So final step is done with an eraser, if we can find it. Okay? Let's just multiply off e to the n squared t, and we have the answer. So e to the n squared t, here it is, e to the minus n squared t. And here it is, e to the minus n squared t. Done. We have found a formula for the Fourier coefficients. And there it is. Done. OK. Now, this is very interesting. We have solved the problem. But there's a little bit of puzzle here. We have to think about this just a little bit. Yeah?
Initially, you said that you could differentiate with respect to
x. We could not differentiate this Fourier series with respect to x, but we never differentiated with respect to x. And we never differentiated a series term by term. It would be very dangerous to differentiate the series term by term. Of course, you could differentiate this whole thing if you wanted to. It's perfectly correct to write d by dx in front. Right? Nothing wrong with that. But you can't interchange this summation and this differentiation. You can't do that, because you would end up with a series that is divergent. But we never differentiated with respect to x. Instead, we differentiated that integral with respect to t, and that integral is uniformly divergent. Got to admit, this is clever. Okay, Fourier series are. You see what we've done? We have embedded the information in the Fourier series. But now the question is, can we get the information out of the Fourier series? Okay, because this is a very, very slowly converging Fourier series. Okay, we know, in fact, I wrote it down over here, we know that a sub n of t goes like 1 over n. So although we have solved the problem, you know, we've solved the problem. If you want to get the answer, plot it, you know, on a computer, you can't do that. Because this series is so slowly converging, it's a conditionally convergent series, that it's essentially worthless to us. So far, this is clever, but it's just a Pyrrhic victory. Okay? What do we have to do to improve the convergence of the Fourier series? What did we do last time? Do you remember that we added and subtracted the leading asymptotic behavior of the Fourier coefficients? So what we need to find out is this. We need to answer the question, how does A sub n behave as n goes to infinity? Once we know the answer to that, we can add and subtract that asymptotic behavior. Do you understand what I'm doing? Remember, we added and subtracted the leading asymptotic behavior. So what are we going to do? How are we going to find out how this behaves for large n? This is a complicated formula. Yeah?
So when we do that, all that we're doing is that the slowly convergent part is being packaged into a different function, which you claim is in some table of integrals.
Some table of series. That's right.
So it's known, the solution to that.
That's right. That's right. In particular, you remember what we used last time. We used the fact last time that the function pi minus x over 2 has a very simple Fourier series. The Fourier series for this function is sum from n equals 1 to infinity sine of nx over n. Okay? And this might be a very useful formula here as well. Why? Because, as we said, we expect a sub n to behave like 1 over n. Bing, bing. Okay? The question is, how do we find the large n behavior of this? What are we going to do? What would you do? This is a very complicated formula. How does this behave for large n? What would you do to answer that question? Do you remember we had a formula for the Fourier coefficients? And we determined the large n behavior in general for Fourier coefficients. What was the technique that we used? Integration by parts. That's the most powerful technique for evaluating the asymptotic behavior of integrals. It's integration by parts. That's it. So let's try and just use integration by parts. Now, we already know that this piece over here is exponentially small. This is e to the minus n squared t. So this piece here is really small. Okay, this doesn't behave like 1 over n. The 1 over n behavior is clearly buried in here. Okay, that's where it's buried. Okay, so the question is, how does 2 over pi, how does this 2n over pi e to the minus n squared t integral from 0 to t ds g of s e to the minus e to the plus n squared s behave for large n? Let's integrate that by parts. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to integrate this function repeatedly and differentiate that function. It's obvious, right? So suppose we integrate this. Okay? This gives us 2n over pi e to the minus n squared t. And now, if you integrate this guy, it gives you e to the n squared s over n squared, right? Times g of s. Okay? Right? And then minus the integral g prime of s e to the n squared s over n squared. Okay? ds. And this integral is taken from 0 to t, and this is evaluated from 0 to t. Now, we're looking for the 1 over n squared, the 1 over n behavior. Look at the lower end point. Okay, at s equals 0, how does this thing behave? This is just a constant. It's multiplied by e to the minus n squared t. So that's exponentially small. We don't care about that. The only thing we care about is the upper endpoint, because at the upper endpoint, how does this thing behave? This guy behaves at the upper endpoint like 2n over pi, see it? 2n over pi times e to the minus n squared t times e to the plus n squared t, those guys cancel, right? Times 1 over n squared times g of t. Right? So this guy behaves, cancel the n's, like 2 over pi n g of t, as promised. That's what the Fourier series behaves like. This integral is just like the original integral, except it has the same form as the original integral, except that it has an n squared in the bottom. And that n squared is multiplying this n on top. But you could see this thing, if I integrate by parts again, it's going to give me a contribution of order 1 over n cubed. And if I integrate by parts, I'll get 1 over n to the 5, 1 over n to the 7, and so on and so on and so on. So this is the biggest piece. So you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to write, I've done my approximate calculation, I'm going to write a sub n, here's this big complicated formula for a sub n, I'm going to write it like this. I'm going to write it as a sub n minus 2 g of t over pi n. I'm going to subtract that asymptotic behavior. And then I'm going to add it back again, 2 g of t over pi n. OK? And let's call this b of t, b sub n of t. How does b sub n of t behave for large n? Again, let me emphasize. How does this, for large n, how does it behave? Are you following me? Or have I lost you in the dust? How does b sub n of t behave? 1 over n cubed. Right. So therefore, what is our representation? What does the series representation look like? It looks like this. U of x and t is equal to the sum of b sub n times sine of nx from 1 to infinity, n equals 1 to infinity, plus this part. OK? But I know what this Fourier series is. It's just written up here. The Fourier series for the coefficient is 1 over n is precisely, so this is 2 g of t over pi, 2 g of t over pi, and sine of nx over n is just pi minus x over 2. Look what I did. First, I incorporated the answer in a Fourier series. But that Fourier series was slowly converging. Why? Because it was non-uniformly convergent. It was because of the Gibbs phenomenon. But now, I have accelerated the convergence of the series. You can't do Fourier series unless you know how to accelerate the convergence. This Fourier series converges like a shot, OK? Because this b sub n here goes like 1 over n cubed. So this I can put on a pocket calculator and just sum the first few terms, and I'm very happy. I get very, very good accuracy. And this function tells me, and of course, because this is rapidly convergent, how did this function behave at the boundary? What is the value of this function in the box when x equals 0 or x equals pi? It's 0. But this function is, of course, not 0. So let's evaluate this function first at pi. What do you get? 0. Ah, but indeed, you remember we said, let's suppose that h is equal to 0. It says h equals 0. It says it's 0, just the way we assume. What if you evaluate this function at x equals 0? What do you get? G of t. It knows that it's supposed to be equal to g of t at 0. It knew it. The information was there. You see what we've done? We've done something incredibly subtle and clever. What we have argued is as follows. If you add up this stupid Fourier series here, at x equals 0, you'll get 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 an infinite number of times, which is ambiguous, okay, at best. So we're not doing that. What we're doing is starting from the center of the interval and going out to the edge. And if you start at the center and go out to the edge, you've found an indirect sum of the Fourier series. And what do you get? If you evaluate this at x equals 0, you get u of 0 and t is indeed g of t. You can see that. So at the edge, this Fourier series is uniformly convergent, adds up to 0. This explicitly, if you set x equals 0, pi over 2 cancels the 2 over pi, and you get g of t. Bang, just like that. Okay. I hope you're impressed. This is really powerful and useful mathematics. Okay? This is not just formal mathematics that you learn. You know, unfortunately, when Fourier series are discussed in courses, you learn the formal aspects of it, and you think it's very pretty, but you can't do anything with it. You need to know how to sum a series and to accelerate the convergence of the series. Yeah, yeah.
So it means that, in the first place, that we have g of t at one side and h of t at one side.
Right.
We can add some affine combination of g of t and h of t to our u.
Yes,
and
indeed.
So for that new thing that has zero at
that's
both sides.
Exactly correct. That's exactly correct. And that's an indirect way of solving the problem. So what we could do, how could we do that? We could say, look, that's a very hard problem. If we didn't know how to accelerate the convergence, you understand, this is completely routine. What you're suggesting is a sort of a fix. Okay? But suppose I wanted the series to converge faster. What would I do? Suppose I wasn't happy with 1 over n cubed. It's clear what we do. We integrate by parts again. Okay? After the first integration by parts, we know that the series behaves like 1 over n. After the next integration by parts, we'll get a term that behaves like 1 over n cubed. Okay? And it'll involve the derivatives of g. Okay? And then we have to look in a book and find the Fourier series that contains the 1 over n cubed here. Okay, and then we'll sum that up. And then the remaining series, the new series that'll be in the box, goes like 1 over n to the 5. So this is very rapidly convergent. Okay, and we could repeat this process over and over until you're a very happy puppy. Okay, but we can do what you suggest. Okay, what we could do is we could say, let's incorporate the boundary conditions at the beginning of the problem and solve for a homogeneous u, a cell for a u that vanishes on the boundary. So how can we do that? Well, let's let u of x and t equal v of x and t, okay, plus, now, we need something that's equal to g of t at the left-hand side. So we can do that. How about writing down pi minus x over pi, okay, times, say, g of t. Okay? And now we need something that, so this vanishes on the right-hand side, but it's equal to g of t on the left when x is equal to 0. Okay? Now we need something for the right-hand side. So let's write down something like x over pi. So when x is equal to 0, this doesn't contribute. But when x is equal to pi, this is 1, times h of t. Okay? And now, this function u does not vanish on the boundary. But the function v does, by construction, vanish at the boundary. Okay? Now we have to find the differential equation satisfied by v. Okay? So we take this equation, and we plug it into the heat equation. Okay? Now, so it says if you take the time derivative of this, so you take the time derivative of this and you get vt plus pi minus x over pi g prime plus x over pi h prime of t. is equal to two derivatives with respect to x. So that gives me vxx from here. And two derivatives with respect to x kills this and this. These two disappear. So v satisfies this equation, which is an inhomogeneous heat equation. So this is an inhomogeneous heat equation with forcing terms here. So this is a new differential equation. Okay. Now, I can write down a solution for v. I can say, look, u is continuous. It's a nice smooth function because it satisfies the heat equation. This and this are continuous functions. Just, you know, look, the linear function of x. So these are continuous. So v is nice and continuous. So therefore, v has a Fourier series. V of x and t is equal to, let's say, we'll use a new Fourier coefficient, b sub n of t times sine of nx. Okay, so that's the Fourier series for v. Now I ask you, how do the b's behave for large n?
It's not 1 over n cubed.
It's like 1 over n cubed, right? Must be 1 over n cubed because this vanishes at the boundary by construction. Ah, but if it goes like 1 over n cubed, then I can differentiate this twice. So this Fourier series, I can plug into this funny equation here. And if I do that, of course, I have to expand this into a Fourier series as well, and that into a Fourier series. And I can plug this in, and now, term by term, I can match the Fourier coefficients. And if I do that, what am I going to find that b sub n is? It's precisely the thing in the box that I call b sub n here. Okay? It's precisely the same thing. However, this gets messy. Okay? This procedure, it worked to leading order. But it is not an easy routine thing to do in next order if you wanted to make a 1 over n to the 5 converging like 1 over n to the 5 Fourier series. Whereas here, all I have to do is integrate by parts again, and again, and again, and again, 1 over n to the 7, 1 over n to the 9, and so on. Yeah?
On the right-hand side of the equation, we have four derivatives of x, u, x, 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 x.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Could we, again, use this method for a third-order equation?
Sure.
Find that
sure.
Works
the only question is, will you be able to incorporate the boundary data? That's the key thing. You see, we incorporated the boundary data as endpoints when we were integrating by parts. If we are using the wrong kind of Fourier series, you can't incorporate the boundary data. Okay. So what you will end up with is an integral equation in which you don't know the boundary data until you've solved the differential equation, which is another way of, that's a long and clumsy way of saying that you have discovered an integral equation for the answer. And that's hard. To solve that problem, you have to use transform techniques, and that's actually pretty fancy stuff. Yeah.
If you feel boundary conditions are a gradient at one end and a heat path at the other end, which
yes. So now, what would we do? You want to make sure that when you integrate by parts, you have exactly what you need to incorporate what you are given. For example, you could have been told u of x and 0 is g, just as before, but you might have been told ux of pi and t. So here you're given the flux, and here you're given u. So now, what do we want to use in our Fourier series? This is not good. So we would want to do something, we have to work it out, but something like sine of n plus 1 half pi, something like that. Okay. And now, when you're at one end, it vanishes, and the other end, the derivative contributes, and so on and so on. I mean, that's what we want to. We want to do something like this that incorporates the heat bath at one side and the flux at the other side. Okay. And all of these different functions, sine of n pi, cosine of n pi, sine of n plus half pi, and so on, all of these things are complete on the interval from 0 to pi. It's very nice. Okay. If you want to find out exactly what functions are, if you want it, you know, I'm just guessing, this is just off the top of my head, but you know what you have to do. You have to solve, go back all the way back to the very first thing we said. We were solving an eigenvalue problem. Okay, we were saying, suppose you're trying to solve the equation y prime prime, let's put this in a box here. Suppose you're trying to solve the equation y prime prime of x plus y of x times a separation constant. Remember the separation constant? There was a separation constant squared is equal to 0. And the separation constant is the eigenvalue. Okay? And now, if you want to incorporate a heat bath on the left-hand side, that is equivalent to saying that we want y of 0 to be 0. Okay? If you want to incorporate the heat flux on the right-hand side, what we want is for y prime of pi to be 0. Well, you can solve this. You write down a linear combination of sine and cosine, and you impose da-da-da-da, and you impose da-da-da, and then you will get, you'll find what is the system of, you know, what is the set of functions that are natural for the problem that you're trying to solve. Okay? See that? Okay? Yeah?
If we don't have the conditions at the ends, but we have somehow in the middle or somewhere else, it might not be ends.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Is there a condition that ends, sine of something times x, that something is not integer or half integer? Is there a problem?
What is it that you
want to do? We have to expand in terms of sines of lambda n x that lambdas are not integers or half integers.
Yeah, in this case it would be n plus a half.
It's half integer.
Oh, but it might be something, you know. I don't think so, because it's going to be simple, because for a heat equation, all you can do is impose some condition that says that either the function is given or the derivative of the function is given. You might give some sort of mixed condition, like a Robin boundary condition, which might make the function more complicated. You might want to say, yeah, it's possible we can construct something more complicated. You might want to say, I don't want to specify y of 0, but I want to specify y of 0 plus alpha times y prime of 0 is given. Okay, and in that case, this would be your boundary condition. Then it might be a slightly more complicated set of series.
My question is, then it's not a Fourier series anymore.
No, it is. Of course it is. This is the boundary condition. Okay, and you'll find that these separation constants are whatever they turn out to be. This is an eigenvalue problem, perfectly well-defined eigenvalue problem. And this will define the eigenvalue C, and now the solution is going to be y is equal to sine of Cx plus cosine of Cx with the appropriate constants in front. Okay? And this is an infinite, and you'll find an infinite set of C's, eigenvalues C that satisfy this equation.
And that's called a Fourier series as well, when C.
And that's a Fourier series as well, sure. Okay, so enough about that. That's, I think, as much as we want to say for now about converging series and how to accelerate the convergence of the series. I want to begin talking about diverging series, because they're a hell of a lot more interesting. And let me, I think we can say enough that you'll get a flavor of what this is about. There are lots and lots of divergent series that we're going to discuss, okay? We can have rapidly divergent series like a series like this, sum from n equals 0 to infinity, x to the n times n factorial times, say, minus 1 to the n. Okay? That's a wildly diverging series. Diverges like n factorial. The radius of convergence of that series is 0, but I can sum up the series, okay? And I get a unique answer if I sum it up. And you'll see shortly, maybe not probably not today, but you'll see shortly that the sum of this series is, it's well defined, and it is the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t 1 over xt. That's the solution. That's the sum of that series. Okay, and this is a convergent integral, and that's a non-trivial function, and that's the answer. Okay. But what I want to do is start with something simple. So let's take a series that is not so wildly divergent. Let's just take a series 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1. Like that. Okay? So that's our series. Okay? Now, so suppose someone walks up to you and says, what's the sum of that series? Okay, well, you look at it and you say right away, well, that's not a convergent series. It's not convergent. So remember, convergence is an inherent property of a series. If you have a series of the form a sub n, you can answer the question, does this series converge, by looking at that series and nothing else. Okay? Looking at the series and nothing else. What does it mean for the series? What does it mean for this series to converge? It means, so this converges if the partial sum of the series, which is S sub n, is the sum from 0 to n, A sub n. Okay, so this is the partial sum of the series. What does it mean for the series to converge? It means that S sub n approaches a limit as n goes to infinity. That's what it means. Okay? And clearly, the partial sums of this series do not approach a limit, right? The first partial sum, you know, S0 is 1, S1 is 0, S2 is 1 again, and S3 is 0, and they don't converge. Okay? So that's not a convergent series. Okay? All right. So what I'm going to do to begin with is I want to first show you that I can find a sum of the series in some sensible way. Okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to invent a machine that assigns a sum to the series. Now, of course, this machine is not going to add up the series, but we know better than that. Because in the case of the Fourier series, you know, we had to do a very indirect process to find what happens at x equals 0. We didn't do something just 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0. That's an ambiguous result. So we had a very fancy machine over here. And I have to invent a machine here. I'm not going to do something very fancy. I'm going to invent a machine called S, okay, which is a machine that sums the series. So this is some sort of process. And you put in the series into the machine as input. You know, you put in 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 and so on. And the machine goes chugga, 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 like that. And out comes the answer, and it tells you S, the sum of the series. Okay? So Mr. Euler proposed a way to sum series that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't work. And it's called Euler summation. And this is what Mr. Euler says. Okay, remember, you have to listen to what he says, because he was a pretty smart guy. Okay? So what does Euler say? He says, suppose I have a series of the form 0 to infinity a sub n. Okay, and I want to sum that series, and it doesn't converge. Okay? So he says, let's invent the following machine. He says, let's consider the function f of x, which is defined as the sum from 0 to infinity a sub n x to the n. Okay? And he says, suppose this converges. Okay, this is a definition, and he says this is a useful definition, and if the sum exists for x less than 1. Okay, this is so it might be that this exists if the absolute value is less than 1. Of course, it might be that it doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, forget Euler. He doesn't work. Okay? But it might exist. And in our simple case over here, it does exist. Okay? Because Euler's f of x, you know, is the series 1 minus x plus x squared and so on. And that does exist. Okay? So then what Mr. Euler says is, define the sum of the series S is the limit as x approaches 1 of f of x. Okay, so this is exactly what we were doing when we were doing perturbation theory. Remember, we put in a small parameter epsilon, except now we're calling epsilon x. Okay, and then take the limit as, in fact, why am I calling it x? That's stupid. Right? Let's call it epsilon. I mean, this is, you know, try to unify this course, all right? So assuming that this exists for epsilon less than 1, and then we'll define the sum of the series to be that. Okay, so let's try Mr. Euler's game. Okay, now I know what you're thinking. This is really silly. I mean, just a stupid. Okay, but let's try it. Okay, so f of epsilon in this case would be 1 minus epsilon plus epsilon squared minus epsilon cubed, and so on, right? And the sum of this series is 1 over 1 plus epsilon. And so therefore, Mr. Euler says that S is the limit as epsilon goes to 1 of 1 over 1 plus epsilon, which is 1 half. Okay, so Euler says the sum of that series is 1 half. Okay? Okay. Now, I'm absolutely certain I know what you're thinking. You're saying that's absolutely, I'll write it down, this is ad hoc. I mean, it just happened to give an answer. It just worked. But so what? There isn't any meaning to that. It just was a trick, which is really all it is. It's just a trick. Okay. So, however, Euler's machine is just one of an infinite number of possible machines. And there's another machine which is much more powerful than Mr. In fact, Euler's method doesn't always work. Okay, so for example, if I gave you the sum minus 1 to the n times n factorial, could you use Euler's technique? It would be 0, and therefore Euler doesn't work. So Mr. Euler would say, sorry, my machine, my summation machine, is not powerful enough to sum the series. Of course, I've already told you what the answer is. This series also has a finite sum. And it's written down over here. And if you want to know what the sum is at x equals 0, it is the integral from the sum of this series happens to be the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t over 1 plus t. That's the sum of that series. Okay, but Mr. Euler doesn't know how to derive this result. His method is not powerful enough. So there are more powerful methods that can sum greater numbers of series. Okay, so one such method is called Borel summation. Borel came along after Euler, so he had to discover something more powerful. Yeah?
Sorry. What are we doing here? Are we trying to say analytically continue that function beyond the point where we are taking the sum?
That's right. What we're doing is, I mean, you know what, I assume you all understand what we're doing here. We're saying, let us, we don't know how to sum this series, so we say, let us insert a parameter epsilon so that we're working in the complex epsilon plane. Okay. Where is the singularity that causes this, what is the radius of convergence of this series to begin with? I'm glad you raised the point. So what is the radius, tell me, what is the radius of convergence of this series? Say it again? One. That's because there's a singularity in the complex epsilon plane at a distance of one from the origin. Right? Where is that singularity? At minus one. Okay? So we were able to approach plus one, ignoring the singularity at minus one. And how did we do that? First, we summed the series, and then we let epsilon approach plus one. Okay? So we defined it as the analytic continuation for small epsilon. So there, it's pretty transparent what is going on. But now I'm going to show you something that's a little bit less transparent. So that's Borel's summation. So Mr. Borel says, OK, suppose Euler is not powerful enough to sum the series. Yeah?
Yes, in Euler, if we
rearrange the terms in a series like that.
OK, we're going to get to that in a minute. Don't even think of using the word rearrange. OK? We're going to talk about that. Don't let this lecture end. Insist on staying here if I don't use the word, if I don't explain the answer. But I'm going to answer your question in just a moment. Okay. So Borel summation. Okay. Borel works in many cases where Euler fails. Okay. So Borel is very clever. Borel says, he says, I happen to know a formula for n factorial. Okay, he says, n factorial can be written as a simple integral. Okay, it is the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t times t to the n. Now, I hope you all know that formula, right? I mean, it's pretty. How do you just, we better not leave anything unsaid. How do you evaluate that integral? Integration by parts. All right. So no insult unintended. I just wanted to make sure that we had it said, right? So you differentiate t to the n repeatedly. You integrate e to the minus t. Each time you differentiate t to the n, you get n and then n minus 1 and n minus 2, blah, 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 blah. And after you do this n times, all you're left with is the integral of e to the minus t times n factorial, which integrates to 1. OK, so that's how you do that integral. Yeah, yeah.
Insert alpha into the exponential, and then differentiate with respect to alpha n times.
Yeah, you could do that,
and insert
too.
Alpha
yeah.
to 1.
We do that. OK, that's a constructive way instead of a destructive way. Right. Okay, so now what do? Mr. Borel says, suppose we have a series like this, sum from 0 to infinity, a sub n. Now, you understand here that when I write this down, you understand, we could have a sort of philosophical argument. I cannot write this down unless you're willing to agree that we are generalizing this symbol. What is that symbol? That's a sigma. It's a Greek letter sigma, capital sigma, right? Sigma is a Greek S, which means sum. And here it's used as a verb, okay? It instructs you to add up the terms in that series. Okay? Which you cannot do because the series diverges. So you must not add up the terms in the series. You can't do that. So from now on, we're going to think of the letter S is not a verb. It's not a verb instructing you to add up the terms that follow that Greek letter S. But really, it just stands for the word series. okay? But you're not instructed to add it up, because if you were to add it up, you would die, okay? It would blow up, okay? So it's very dangerous. Don't add it up, okay? So now, okay, so what does Mr. Borel say? Mr. Borel says, look, n factorial is this integral. So without changing the series, I can multiply by a sub n times 1 from 0 to infinity, where I will write 1 as a sub n, and I'm going to put an n factorial in the bottom. This is a sub n. Put an n factorial in the bottom, and put this integral from 0 to infinity, dt e to the minus t t to the n, on top in the numerator, OK? And then Mr. Borel says, don't worry about it. Just don't worry. Interchange the orders of summation and integration. Just don't worry. This is just a machine, and machines don't worry, OK? So he says, let's rewrite this as the integral from 0 to infinity, dt e to the minus t times the sum of a sub n, t to the n over n factorial. OK. Now, this is looking like what Mr. Euler did, but it's looking better. OK. Do you see why it's looking better? Because this sum in here has a very good chance of existing, because there's an n factorial in the bottom. So it may be that we can add this up, and when we add this up, we'll get some function, which we, in honor of Borel, maybe we'll call this Borel or something like that, b of t. Okay? And then Borel says, once you've added this up and gotten this function, then all you need to do is to evaluate the integral of e to the minus t b of t. You can do that if you want. Okay? And when you do that, we will define this as the sum of the series. So this is a definition. Okay? Now, I know what you're thinking. This is yet another ad hoc procedure. But just for laughs, let's try that procedure. Let's try that procedure on the series that we summed using Euler summation. Okay, so suppose Mr. Borel, who never met Mr. Euler, was given the series 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 and so on, and he was told to add that up. So Mr. Borel would say, all right, what we will do is we will write down the sum from 0 to infinity of minus 1 to the n. That's the terms in the, this is a sub n. It's the nth term in the series, okay? Times the integral from 0 to infinity e to the minus t times t to the n over n factorial. And then Mr. Borel interchanges the integral and the sum. So he gets e to, integral dt. This is, I didn't write dt. Okay, dt e to the minus t times the sum of t to the n minus 1 to the n over n factorial. Okay? And then he says, oh, I know what that sum is. What is that sum? E to the minus t. Okay, that's just the function e to the minus t. So Mr. Borel says the sum of the series is the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t times e to the minus t, which is e to the minus 2t, okay, which is 1 half. Very interesting. It's actually startling, because out of an infinite number of possible numbers, we got the same answer that Mr. Euler got. So, I mean, we were in danger. Euler was just about ready to turn over in his grave, okay, because Borel was going to get a different answer. But remarkably, we got exactly the same answer. So maybe it is possible in some sense. I mean, this obviously, well, this is begging the question, right? The question is there some universal sense in which there really is a unique sum to that series? I mean, we invented one summation machine and we got one half. And we invented another, well, we didn't. It was invented for us. And we got one half. Okay? But before we discuss, so next time I'm going to argue very strongly that, in fact, there is a universal summation procedure, okay, which will give us a well-defined sum of the series. But now we have to answer your question. It was your question, right? Okay, so you were going to get angry at me if I ended the lecture with that. Okay, so there are several remarks we have to make, very, very important remarks. The first remark is that when you were a little boy, and I remember when you were a little boy, you learned the laws of arithmetic, right? You were taught, you were probably only about 3 years old, and you were learning arithmetic, right? And you learned that the arithmetic system, the arithmetic number system, has three fundamental laws. The first law is commutivity, okay? And the second law is associativity. And the third law is distributivity. And commutivity, what does commutivity mean? It means that the order in which you perform an operation can be reversed. That is, you learned that A plus B equals B plus A, or that AB equals BA. That's commutivity, okay? And you learned that the arithmetical system, the real number system, satisfies that law, okay? And the complex number system as well, okay? It's amazing because you're only 3 years old when you learn that. Okay, okay. So then you learn associativity. Okay, and associativity means that A plus B plus C is the same thing as A plus B plus C. So associativity means it doesn't matter which order you perform an operation like addition, and the same is true with multiplication. Okay. Distributivity is really a deeper and more fundamental law, because distributivity says, what does it actually say? I mean, it says something, I mean, because you know what, it says that A times B plus C is AB plus AC, but what is the fancier term that you learned when you were, say, six, you know? I mean, this is distributivity, but I mean, the fundamental concept that's here is linearity. Okay, linearity. Okay, linearity. The point is that you can that this operation of multiplication, this multiplication here, is linear in the sense that A times B plus C is the same as A times B added to A times C. So A multiplies through in a linear fashion. Okay, so this is in some sense a much fancier and more fundamental law. This just refers to the arithmetic processes, the order in which you're doing operations. Okay, now if you go back and look at the series that we were summing, which I'm sort of suggesting to you has a universal sum. Of course, I'm only suggesting it. We just tried two machines and happen to give the same answer. If we invented a third machine, it might give a different answer. Okay, we'd be willing to believe that. But look at what happens. Suppose, for example, just suppose you try associativity. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Suppose you were to add up this number and this number, and then this number and that these numbers in that order, then this series would be 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0, which is now a convergent series. And there's no ambiguity about that. The sum of that series is 0. Okay? On the other hand, if you had used associativity and you summed up these numbers, and these numbers, and these numbers, and these numbers, and so on, then each of these associations would give 0. Okay? Added to 1. So then you would say, associativity tells me that the sum of the series is either 0, if I associate the numbers in one way, or 1, if I associate the numbers in another way. Okay? And the conclusion of that is that arithmetic that you were lied to. Okay? So remember, the chance of a given series being summable, converging, that is 0. Okay? It's only a set of measure 0 of series are actually summable. Okay? And those series, for the series that are not summable, you definitely do not have associativity. So associativity, the associative law in arithmetic, is, this is not quite stated, the correct statement is that arithmetic is finitely associative. You can associate a finite number of terms, no one is objecting to that, but if you try to do it an infinite number of times, you get garbage. Okay? So you can't trust the associative law, can't apply it an infinite number of times and expect it to work. Okay, you have to do it very carefully. Okay? Now, what about commutivity? Commutivity says it doesn't matter what order you perform in an operation, perform an arithmetic operation in. Okay? So what you could do is you could just interchange the first two terms and interchange the next two terms and interchange the next two terms, blah, 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 blah. Okay? And the series you would end up with would be the series minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, and so on, okay, which is minus the original series, okay? And if it makes sense to talk about the sum of the original series, we just showed, I mean, if the sum of this original series is 1/2, then now we're arguing that the sum of the series is minus 1/2. So Euler, go away. Okay? But in fact, the answer to this objection is that also arithmetic is only finitely commutative. Okay? So this you have to, let me put some exclamation points here to indicate that arithmetic is only finitely commutative and only finitely associative. You can't commute an infinite number of numbers in a series, okay? Yeah, I think I know what you're gonna say, but go ahead and say.
Why should we believe more Euler than commutivity?
Yeah, so I'm gonna show you, okay? So let's actually do some of these processes in a convergent series, okay? What's an example of a convergent series? How about the series 1 minus 1/2 plus 1/3 minus 1/4 and so on? There are an infinite number of series of this form. This is an alternating series. This is a series of the form a sub n times minus 1 to the n. And this series is a sum of this. This converges to what again? We've already summed this series once. But what is the sum of this series? Well, if you add it up in the indicated order, it is equal to log of 2, right? However, I claim that if you allow me to do an infinite number of associations and, you know, commutations, if you allow me to do that, I can make this series add up to pi. You don't believe me? All right. Here's the recipe. I'm going to make this series add up to pi just by assuming that arithmetic is infinitely commutative and associative. How do we do that? No problem. What I'm going to do is take, so there are a bunch of positive numbers in the series and a bunch of negative numbers. The rule is, to make this add up to pi, I'm going to take the positive numbers one at a time in the series until I get, until they add up to a number just above pi, until they just pass pi. Now, how do I know I can do that? Is that true? Will, if I start taking the positive numbers, will it eventually, why is it, why will I go? It's a divergent series, that's right. The series 1 plus a third plus a fifth is a divergent series. So if I start adding the numbers together, eventually it'll go just above pi. Okay? So as soon as I go above pi, I stop. Okay? Whoop. Okay? Now I start adding on the negative numbers. So I take a bunch of negative numbers until I go just below pi. Will I get below pi? Yes, because the sum of the negative numbers in the series diverges. So I will go below pi. As soon as I go below pi, whoop, I stop, okay, and I start taking the positive numbers, okay, until I go just above pi. And then I take, using new positive numbers, I mean, I take the numbers one at a time. I don't use them twice. Okay, I keep going. And then I keep going with negative numbers, and I keep going with positive. And if I look at the partial sums of this series, the partial sums, here's pi, here's n. So what you see is that the numbers have gone just above pi, and then they've gone just below pi and just above pi. But each time I go above and each time I go below, I go above by smaller amounts, because the numbers are getting smaller and smaller, even though it's a divergent series. So the partial sums are oscillating about pi with smaller and smaller oscillations. So unambiguously, this is converging to pi. Absolutely unambiguously. Actually, I made a mistake. I didn't want to make the series converge to pi. I really wanted to make it converge to 79. My second favorite number. Okay, so can we make it converge to 79? Of course, by exactly the same argument, it converges to 79. So if you allow me to interchange the order of addition, even in a convergent series, you get nonsense. Or this isn't nonsense. It's just that arithmetic is not infinitely commutative. And that's all I was doing. I was interchanging the orders of the numbers, and you can't do that, even in a convergent series. Okay? Yeah?
18.
Why?
Well, I'll tell you a story. Okay, I'll tell you a story about 18. So there was a very old farmer, horse farmer, who was fairly rich, okay, had lots of horses. In fact, he had 17 of them, okay? And the guy croaked, okay? And he had three sons, and the sons were opening the reading his will, okay? And he said, in his will, I leave half of my wealth to my oldest son and a third of my wealth to my middle son and a ninth of my wealth to my youngest son. Okay. And they said, 17 horses? How are we going to take half of 17? How are we going to take a ninth of 17 horses? So they called up the wise man in the town, who happened to be an applied mathematician. The wise man, they told him the problem. The wise man said, I'll think about it. And the next day, he said, meet me tomorrow. Next day, he rode in on his horse. And he put his horse in the corral with the other 17 horses, making 18 horses. Okay? And then they took half of the 18 horses, which was 9, and gave it to the oldest son. And a third of the 18 horses, which was 6, and gave it to the middle son. And a ninth of the 18 horses, which was 2, and gave it to the youngest son. They had now given away 17 horses. Okay, so the wise man got back on his horse and rode away. Okay. That's a really stupid answer to your question. Okay. Ah, that's a secret.
Is that the birth year of a lot of
people? No, I just made that up on the spot. Okay, yes?
Does it make sense to talk about the arithmetic mean of partial sums? Because that gives the right result for this one.
Yes, in some sense it does, and in fact, that's a very insightful remark, very clever remark, because there's another summation machine called Cesaro, or Cesaro, summability. Probably Cesaro, not Cesaro. Okay? It sounds like a Shakespearean character. But okay. So, and in Cesaro summability, what you do is you take arithmetic means. Okay? So you could do that too. And if you use Cesaro summability to sum this series, guess what? You get 1/2. So this is really great. I don't organize my lectures, but it just happened again. You see, I'm going to leave you hanging. The question is, do you really believe, this is suggesting that there is some sort of universal way, there's some universal meaning to the sum of a divergent series. Okay? And I'm going to try to argue that next time. I'm going to try to show you that there really is a universal meaning to what we're doing.